out of proportion, almost spidery. His hair was a dirty grey mop, his face covered by sparse white stubble. He was dressed in a suit about 2 decades out of date, in sober shades of brown and grey, and large, soft slippers made of some kind of creature with green and black striped fur. Too old to be middle-aged, too young to be elderly. The man had eyes that were a vibrant shade of blue Grimm had seen only in the autumn skies high above the mists. The man walked with the aid of a wooden cane tipped with what might have been a weapons crystal from a ship's light cannon. It was the size of a man's clenched fist.
"Ah," he said, "aha, Captain Grimm, welcome, welcome. So good to be able to speak to you when you aren't delirious."
He glanced aside at the girl and mumbled out of the corner of his mouth,
"He's not delirious, is he?"
The girl shook her head with wide eyes that didn't leave the ground.
"No, master."
Grimm was quite unsure how to respond with courtesy to such a greeting, but he settled for bowing slightly at the waist.
"We haven't met, sir. I'm afraid you have the advantage of me."
"Yes, we did. Tomorrow," the old man said. "And no, you aren't. And the last is a matter for debate, perhaps. What do you think, Folly?"
Folly bit her lip and touched her vial of crystals.
"He doesn't realize that Captain Grimm is quite uncomfortable, because he doesn't know anyone's name."
"Untrue," the etherealist stated with conviction. "He knows his own name, I dare say, and at least one of yours. He's had seconds and seconds to transfer that knowledge into his memory. Unless, of course, he remains delirious."
The old man squinted at Grimm. "You're quite sure that you are lucid, sir?"
"At times I wonder," Grimm replied. Something very young and very full of mischief flickered far back in the etherealist's eyes, and his face stretched into a wide smile.
"Ah! Ah! A man of modesty. Either so false that it may be true, or so true that it seems entirely false. I can see why Bayard speaks so well of you, sir."
The old man touched the tip of his cane to the floor, far to one side, and sank into an elaborate bow of dance-like grace.
"I am Epherus Ephrenus Ferris, at your service, sir. And that's Folly."
"Folly,"
the girl said, and bobbed a curtsy toward the far corner of the room.
"Sweaters,"
Ferris said soberly.
"Sweaters, dear.
And 2 pairs of socks, one of them wool. Oh, and fetch me a gentleman's hat of a size no larger than 6, and then soak it in vinegar."
The girl curtsied again and hurried from the room. Ferris beamed.
"Such a sweet child, and she always remembers perfectly.
Now then, Captain."
He turned back to Grimm.
"You have questions, I answers. Shall we see if they match?"
"Please,"
Grimm said. "I appear to be your guest. Have I you to thank for caring for me?" Ferris's shoulders sagged in evident disappointment.
"Oh, apparently they do not match. I was going to say strawberries."
His lips compressed and he shook his head.
"You aren't very good at this game, Captain."
"I take that to mean that you did help me, sir." Ferris waved a hand.
"Bayard did more for you than I did, I dare say.
But that said, yes, I was compelled to employ my skills on your behalf."
"Skills, sir?"
The etherealist nodded.
"Today I'm a physician with the cure to a condition hardly anyone ever contracts. If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I'd have told you it seemed a very poor long-term investment with very little commercial viability, but here we are."
Grimm found himself smiling. "Indeed, here we are. Thank you for your help." The old man beamed and drummed the end of his cane on the floor.
"Oh, just so, just so. Whatever beastie it was tried to eat you. It left a good many dangerous structures behind in your blood. Quite rude, sir. Quite rude and most unfair.
Poison? Grim asked. Ferris waggled his hand back and forth.
Yes. No, actually. Not even remotely. But for purposes of this conversation, yes.
Grim frowned. Am I in any danger?
You're as dead as a stone, man.
I am?
Yes. No, actually, not even remotely, but for purposes of this conversation, yes.
Ferris nodded at his arm.
You've clouded the issue. I should check your wound to ensure my work was thorough. Do you mind?
No, Grim said. I suppose not.
Excellent, Ferris said.
Then he turned and left the room, banging the door shut behind him. Grim stood for a moment, frowning. Then he shook his head and began to seat himself again.
Ah! Cried Ferris from the hall. No! Stop moving, man! How am I supposed to see anything with you dancing jigs about the room?
Grim froze in place. Is this better?
You look rather awkward, halfway down, like that. You aren't by chance having a bowel movement of some kind?
Grim sighed. No.
Well, try not to, until I'm finished.
Master Ferris, if you don't mind my asking, how exactly are you examining me? Surely you can't see the wound from out there.
Untrue, Ferris said.
From out here, I can see little else. There, done.
I do good work, if I do say so myself.
Footsteps shuffled up to the door and then stopped warily, perhaps a foot away. The doorknob rattled again fitfully and then went still.
Bother, Ferris said. Confounded thing, why do you mock me?
Grim walked across the room and opened the door. Ferris let out a sigh.
Ah, thank you, young man, thank you. Were I your age, I'm sure I would learn the trick of it straight off, but the mind, you see, it goes rather stale.
It's the least I could do, Grim said.
Incorrect,
Ferris proclaimed. The least you could have done would be nothing. Goodness, I hope you're brighter than you seem. We've really no more time to waste upon your education, Captain. No? Grim asked. And why not? And in an instant, the old man changed. His previously animated voice went low and steady. Something shifted in his spine and shoulders, conveying a sense of perfect confidence and strength, wildly at odds with his innocuous stature. And most of all, his eyes changed. The sparkle in them transformed, distilled itself into a muted fire that met Grimm's gaze without expectation or weakness. Grim became abruptly certain that he was standing before a very dangerous man.
Because, Francis Madison Grim, we've come to the end,
Master Ferris said.
The end? Of what?
Of the beginning, of course,
the Etherealist said.
The end of the beginning.
Chapter 9. Spire Albion. Habble Morning.
I can't believe you're going along with this,
Gwendolen told Benedict. She tried to keep her voice pleasant and neutral. Her cousin eyed her and slipped a half step farther away from her as they walked together toward the duel.
Oh, please,
Gwendolen said, allowing her tone to become openly cross.
Now you're just teasing me.
Benedict smiled very slightly.
Raoul seemed insistent.
Raoul, Gwendolen said, is a cat, Benedict.
Have you ever tried to stop a cat from doing what it wants to do? Benedict asked her.
No, of course not. There are no cats in House Lancaster.
Benedict barked a sharp laugh. That again. Gwendolen felt her face heat slightly.
I've never seen one there, she continued, as if he hadn't interrupted her at all. The point is, Benny, that if I spent a lifetime thinking they were little more than clever beasts, you can be sure that many others have as well.
And?
And word has spread. Everyone in the Habble will be watching this duel today. This will be the first time House Tarquin has impinged upon the awareness of the great houses in a generation. Can you imagine what they're going to be saying about Bridget and her father if she shows up with a bloody cat as her second?
I can,
Benedict said, his voice maddeningly calm. Yes, indeed.
Now, what is that supposed to mean?
Gwen demanded. Honestly, cuz, I know you're still a recruit, but I can't very well go explaining everything to you. You've seen everything I have. You've had the same education I have. You have an excellent mind when you bother to bring it in on a consult with your temper, I mean. Use it. Gwen scowled at him.
I have. It tells me that the name of Tarquin is in danger today, she said, and it's there because of my own stupidity, and that we can't allow them to come to harm because of my mistake.
Yes, Benedict said. All true. But take it a step further. What are the consequences of today? Gwen pressed her lips together for a moment before speaking.
If she loses the duel, the Tarquins will be both a laughingstock and a highly visible target of economic opportunity. At the very least, their income might suffer. It's probable that one of the hungrier houses with interests in that market will find a way to buy out their vattery or legislate them out of business.
True, Benedict said. And if she wins?
That's a far worse circumstance, Gwen said. If she beats Reggie, she incurs the ire of a major house. Might, and probably, transfigure to will and certainly.
Benedict nodded. House Tarquin. House Astor. Yes, you've done the math, he considered.
Well, two-thirds of it anyway.
What do you mean, two-thirds?
He held up a forefinger. You've accounted for the Tarquins. He held up the next finger. You've considered the Astors. He stuck his thumb out to one side. What about the cats? Gwen let out an impatient breath, but then she paused.
There are really cats inside House Lancaster?
Gwen asked.
And I've just never seen them.
Benedict spread his hands as if displaying that fact's self-evidence.
But I suppose it does not necessarily follow that they have not seen me.
Ah, Benedict said, his tone pleased. The light dawns. Gwen considered that for several steps.
Are they truly that intelligent? I know the little beasts are clever, but
it is often very useful for others to think you less intelligent than you are, Benedict said, his tone amused. It works particularly well against those who aren't as intelligent as you in the first place. Gwen blinked.
Goodness.
I must admit that I hadn't thoroughly considered the situation before meeting Raoul, Benedict said. It's just a theory, cuz. But it seems sound.
It does, doesn't it?
Gwen said. She looked up at Benedict shrewdly.
You've never been known for your acute political intellect, Benny. Most of the house considers you a distant and disinterested observer, not a political asset.
Her cousin looked pained. And I shall remain so in their eyes, if you please, he said. Politics is the purview of scoundrels, tyrants, and fools. I only observe because I prefer not to become their victim. Gwen snorted.
You're safe from everyone but me, she promised.
Oh, dear. His stomach made a rumbling noise, and Gwen smiled up at him.
Hungry?
I've eaten, he replied.
You're warrior-born, Benny, Gwen said firmly. Your body needs more fuel. There's nothing wrong with that.
He pressed his lips together, and his feline eyes became remote. Gwen let out a mental sigh. She knew how much Benny disliked being born different, and the pains to which he went to conceal those differences. She knew he never moved as quickly or as powerfully as he could have during runs or in combat training. He carried lumen crystals with him, and employed them in the darker sections of the Habbel, despite the fact that his feline eyes had no need of them. He ate on a rigid schedule in the guard's dining hall, downing exactly the portions dealt out to each recruit, despite the fact that he could quite literally starve to death on a diet that would be more than adequate for anyone else. Benny was a wonderful, sweet, dear idiot, Gwen thought. "We're eating before the duel," she said firmly. "Come with me."
"Gwen," he protested.
"I'm hungry," she lied smoothly. "And you wouldn't be so rude as to make a lady eat alone, would you? Come along."
Benedict scowled.
"I haven't any money with me."
"I have lots," Gwen said cheerfully. "Come along."
"Honestly, Gwendolyn," he muttered, "you simply cannot take a hint."
"Oh, I'm more than capable of it, cuz," she said airily. "At the moment, I choose not to. Shall we have those dumplings you like?"
Benedict's stomach rumbled, louder. He eyed her. "That's cheating."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Gwen said, and gave him what she liked to think of as her very firm smile, the one where she locked her jaw. She spoke through her teeth. "Now come along." Benedict glowered for a moment more and then sighed. "You're going to insist, aren't you?"
"I'm a lady of House Lancaster, Benny. You are a gentleman of House Sorrelin Lancaster."
"I shouldn't need to."
She smiled, firmly. Benedict rolled his eyes, plucked a white handkerchief from his pocket, and gave it a solemn wave.
"I yield."
Gwendolyn beamed.
"Commendable."
The little stall, where a stout, silver-haired old couple named Beach served hot food to order, was off to the side of the main market area, out of the immediate swirl of trade and foot traffic. The backs of other stalls formed a little C-shaped alcove, where a few simple tables and chairs had been set out, creating the impression of seclusion. Gwen marched up to the stall, but found no one in sight.
"Hello?" she called. "We've come for some lunch."
"We're not quite ready yet," called a voice from inside the stall.
"Become ready,"
Gwen called back, a merry edge in her command.
"I'm glad to pay very well for your trouble."
There was a sigh from inside the stall, and then an older man with eyebrows approximately as thick as his wrists appeared from the pantry in the rear. Mr. Beach blinked once at Gwen and then said,
"Miss Lancaster, this isn't your usual hour. What are you doing here?"
"Securing your profit margin for the day,"
Gwen said, smiling and dropping a coin purse on the counter. It jingled invitingly. Neither the sound of the coin nor her smile seemed to displease the vendor.
"I'm in need of one of your dumplings before noon."
"Simple enough, miss. Coming up. And for the young sir?"
"Two more of the same," Gwen said firmly.
"Cause,"
Benedict protested. It was, Gwen thought, a decidedly feeble protest, undermined by another rumble from his stomach.
"Right away, miss," said Mr. Beach,
and he turned to his stove, where a pan of oil awaited, and produced a number of sausages from an insulated cold cabinet. Mrs. Beach appeared from the back, her grey hair held back under a kerchief, stirring vigorously at a batch of dough. She spread some flour on a board and plopped the dough onto it to begin kneading it with swift, confident hands.
"I'll hear no back talk from you, Benedict," Gwen said, offering him a tart smile. "Or rather, I shall hear none from your belly, for an hour or two at least. Honestly, it's most unbecoming a Lancaster, grumbling and growling like that."
Benedict rolled his eyes again, but his mouth quirked at the corners.
"Fortunately for me,
I'm not so limited as you poor, pure Lancasters, having the Sorrelin bloodline to broaden my mental, emotional, and artistic horizons.
What's that?
Gwen asked, and propped a hand to her ear, raising her voice slightly.
I'm certain I didn't hear you correctly over the sound of your belly howling. It almost sounded as if you were questioning the utter and unquestionable superiority of the House of Lancaster.
Benedict's smile widened. Go play with your crystals and let the rest of us get on with the real work, eh?
For shame, sir, said Mr. Beach,
peering up at Benedict from beneath his bushy eyebrows, his eyes glinting with amusement.
To speak so of the young Mrs. Family?
Gwen gave Benedict a triumphant smile.
There, you see? The Lancasters have the support of the people.
Benedict laughed.
You're only taking her side because she's paying.
The young sir is wise, commented Mrs. Beach.
Aye, he is. He is, agreed the old man, as Gwen counted out a generous number of coins into his palm. She stuck out her tongue at Benedict cheerfully and said,
Thank you both very much.
A rather bookish-looking man of middle years entered the alcove, muttering,
Just don't see how that's going to work.
His clothes, though fine, were rumpled and askew, and his violet waistcoat was an affront to the sensibilities of a generation against the plain brown tweed of his coat and trousers. His hair was brown and overgrown, muddled with strands of grey, and his hands were long-fingered and fine. He was writing in a journal, with a pen fitted with a glowing crystal, muttering to himself as he did.
"Good day, Mr. and Mrs. Beach,"
he said without looking up. He stifled a yawn with one hand, and then continued writing.
"A double of your finest, and with some coffee, if you will.
Nice and dark."
The pen flew over the page, scrawling out a line of some sort of figures Gwen didn't recognize.
"Good day, Eddie," said Mrs. Beach, her voice warm. "Up all night again."
"The curse of an academically inclined mind, I'm afraid,"
the man replied.
"Miles and miles of different ways to think the same old useless things."
He never stopped writing as he spoke, and he bumped into Gwen with the edge of his journal.
"Oh, pardon me, sir."
"Sir?" Gwen asked in an arch tone.
"Yes?"
Addie asked, finishing a line with a flourish and beginning the next. Gwen cleared her throat, quite obviously indicating that she expected him to look up.
"Out with it, man," Addie said. "If you've something on your mind, just say it. I'm a bit too pressed for time to dance about."
Gwen's eyes narrowed and turned steely.
How dared this person be so discourteous to a lady, and most particularly to a lady of House Lancaster?
"'Cause," Benedict said quickly, putting a hand on her arm. She shook it off.
"A moment, cousin," Gwen said. "I'm faced with a distasteful quandary."
"But..."
"Benedict,"
Gwen said in her sweetest, gentlest voice. Benedict grimaced and took a small step back. Addie, if such was his name, was still writing, all but ignoring her. Intolerable.
"Hm?"
he asked absently.
"Quandary?"
Gwen's voice came out cold and precise.
"Whether to settle for a tongue-lashing for someone so impolite, or to take offence at this slight and demand satisfaction as is my right."
Addy blinked several times, and only then did he look up at Gwen.
"I say, really?
Demand satisfaction?"
Mirth bubbled underneath the words, as if he could hardly contain laughter.
"You're considering challenging me to a duel?"
"I will have your name first, sir," Gwen snapped.
"Does it matter?" Addie asked.
"Of course it does," Gwen said. "I would know which house has been so slovenly as to allow one of its scions to wander about Habble Morning without the manners God gave a goat."
"Goats are actually rather gentle, sensible creatures,"
Addie replied in a mild tone.
"And they rarely burst into duels, certainly not after an all-nighter."
He sighed. Miss, should my name matter?
What?
Gwen asked. My name, Addie said. Are my actions not my own? Should it matter if I belong to a low house or high? Am I any more offensive as a common citizen than as one of the aristocracy?
Gwen blinked several times. His questions were so odd that they might have been phrased in a foreign tongue. Then she said, "Of course it should matter. I judge you no commoner by your clothes, sir, but if you are, I can hardly castigate you for your lack of graces when no education in such matters has been yours."
Addie tilted his head sharply to one side, and his dark eyes glittered.
"You would hold me more accountable if I belonged to the aristocracy."
"Of course," Gwen said. Her tone suggested that the man was an idiot.
"Protocol between members of the houses is the standard by which appropriate respect is given to one's peers, respect that keeps those houses from feuds and civil war. It is your duty to behave properly, sir. To those whom much is given, much is required. Of course I expect more of you."
A slow smile spread over Addie's face.
"Oh, interesting."
He looked past Gwen to the two vendors.
"How long?"
Mr. Beach was already moving to draw a brass wire basket from the heated oil, and he began setting the dumplings out onto square bits of cloth.
"Coming up now."
Addie nodded at him and turned to Benedict.
"All right," he said. "Would you be so good as to introduce me to your cousin, sir?"
"I think I like her."
Gwen blinked several times.
"I beg your pardon?"
Benedict drew in a deep breath and eyed Gwen with fond exasperation.
"Cuz," he said, "you really must learn to shut your mouth from time to time. You'll taste less shoe leather."
Straightening his coat, he bowed and said, "Gwendolyn Margaret Elizabeth Lancaster, daughter of Lord Minister and Lady Lancaster, it is my singular pleasure to introduce you to His Majesty Addison Orson Magnus Jeremiah Albion, First Citizen and Spyrarch of Albion." Gwen stared at Benedict in shock for a second. Her stomach absolutely disconnected itself from the rest of her vitals and plunged into some unimaginable abyss. She slowly turned her gaze to the pleasantly smiling Spyrarch. Then her face began to turn very, very hot.
"Miss Lancaster," the Spyrarch said, with a small, pleased bow, "what a unique pleasure it has been to make your acquaintance."
Gwen stared at him, appalled.
You don't look like your portrait."
"I was younger and a good deal angrier when it was painted," he replied. "I don't blame you one bit, Miss Lancaster. I haven't been to a public function since you were a small child, I should think. There's no reason at all you should have recognized me."
I just... sir,"
Gwen stammered. She felt her hands twitch and could only assume it was because the endless hours of instruction in protocol had instilled the proper forms into her very nerves. He smoothly captured her hand and bowed over it.
"Young lady, you are every bit as beautiful as your mother was when she was your age."
"Ah, breakfast. Or lunch. Lunch fast, perhaps," the Spyrarch said, as the Beaches produced the fresh hot dumplings and glasses of chilled juice on a serving tray.
"Would the two of you care to join me?"
Gwen
gave Benedict a rather desperate look. Benedict took a moment to smile at her and, she realized, to bask in the expression on her face. He was clearly enjoying the situation with an absolutely sadistic amount of amusement.
"We should be delighted, sire," he replied.
"Excellent,"
the Spyrarch said.
"There are fine tables just there, I think."
He picked up the tray, smoothly leaving coins for his own dumpling on the counter as he did. He favored Gwen with a polite smile and a nod in the proper direction.
"Ladies first."
Gwen took a slow breath. Then she said to Benedict,
"I am a perfect idiot."
and began walking to the tables. The Spyrarch lifted an eyebrow and glanced up at Benedict.
"That's Gwenish, for I apologize," Gwen heard him say soberly behind her. "After you, sire."
They set to the food in an awkward silence that soon changed to an appreciative one.
"My word, that's good," Benedict breathed.
He obviously tried to restrain himself, but just as obviously was having trouble doing anything but cramming the entire mass of dumpling into his mouth all at once. His food disappeared in large bites. Gwen had just offered the most appalling insolence to the monarch of Spire Albion. She felt as if whatever she'd had at breakfast that morning might come up, and barely touched her own dumpling.
"The food here is better than anything I could get in the manor without waiting for hours," the Spyrarch acknowledged. "The Beeches moved up to Havel Morning from Havel Landing 10 years ago. I offered them a position on my staff, but they preferred to make their own way. I like that."
Benedict nodded, but he didn't stop chewing.
"So, Master Sorrelin," the Spyrarch said, "I'm surprised to see you back this year, after what happened last spring."
Benedict shrugged a shoulder.
"It hardly left a scar."
"Too bad,"
the Spyrarch said, his eyes sparkling. "I'm told young ladies swoon over them." Gwen lifted her eyebrows.
"Benny? Whatever is he talking about?"
Benedict suddenly looked uncomfortable and kept his eyes focused on his food.
"Benedict was serving a year with the guard," the Spyrarch said. "I sent him, as part of a small team, down to Havel Risen to track down a missing shipment of weapons crystals. The thieves, who had them, declined to yield up their prize."
Gwen's eyes widened.
"You were in battle?"
"It wasn't a battle," Benedict replied quickly. "Just a scuffle over getting through the door of their hideout. Hardly worth mentioning."
"A scuffle in which a guardsman was badly wounded," the Spyrarch said, "and in which your cousin killed two armed men who were beating one of his fellow guardsmen with clubs. After that, he pushed 6 more back through their own front door, despite all they could do to hold it against him. One of them stabbed him in the arm for his trouble."
"It wasn't much of a wound,"
Benedict said. His face looked flushed.
"He saved a number of lives," the Spyrarch said, "including those of his companions and most of the thieves. Never mind the havoc that could have been loosed if those crystals had flooded the black market."
He blinked and looked at Gwen.
"He received the Order of the Spire."
"I assumed you knew."
"To my knowledge, he never said anything about it,"
Gwen said, staring hard at Benedict.
"This is the first I've heard of the matter. You told me you hurt your arm in a sparring match, Benny."
Benedict ducked his head and picked up the second dumpling. The first had vanished with unseemly haste, despite his efforts to slow down. The Spyrarch smiled.
"Miss Lancaster, may I call you Gwen?"
"Of course, sire."
"Excellent. But you must not call me sire. Addison will do nicely."
Gwen hesitated.
"Sire."
The Spyrarch waved his hand. "I know the protocol, but it was created 2 centuries ago when Gregor the Strong united the Havels and formed the Council.
When he still had active executive power and an army to back it up."
"Sire."
"Addison, sir,"
Gwen stammered.
"You are still the Spyrarch."
He laughed.
"The monarchy was a necessary evil at one time, Miss Lancaster. Now I'm largely obsolete, and quite content to have it that way. Your father and the council manage the affairs of the Spire by consensus, and all the Havels are represented in a fashion that at times borders upon being fair. The only armed forces we need within the Spire are the Guard, and they generally coordinate humanitarian efforts. I don't rule, Miss Lancaster, nor did my father or grandfather.
I just try to help my people when they need it.
You are the Spyrak, sire, Gwen insisted. All the nobility honour you. All are honoured to serve you.
Merciful builders, but you're young,
he said with a whimsical smile. Wait until I issue some sort of proclamation that cuts into their bank accounts, and I suspect they'd honour me with a mob and clubs.
He shook his head. It's tradition, true, for young nobles to volunteer to serve in the guard, a mark of status. But it's an arbitrary one in many ways. If I attempt to push past my boundaries, I expect some other activity might suddenly replace the guard for high-profile service to the community.
Not everyone feels that way, sire, Benedict said quietly. Not all of us see you as a relic.
Not the Lancasters, Gwen added.
Perhaps not, the Spyrak said thoughtfully. But be that as it may.
I'm interested, Gwen, in why you wish to join the guard. I am the only child of my father's line, she replied,
and as such may be excused from such duty with no loss of honour to you or your family. No one would think ill of you for avoiding your term of service.
Gwen lifted her chin slightly. I would, sire. The Spyrak sat back in his seat and eyed her for a moment. Then he said, I will show you no favouritism whatsoever, Miss Lancaster, despite your importance to your father's house. You will be given assignments like any other recruit. Some of those assignments might carry you into danger. More young men and women than I care to remember have been hurt or killed in the line of duty while following my commands. Do you understand?
Yes, I do, sire.
He finished the last few bites of his dumpling with a pensive frown. Then he turned to Benedict. The same goes for you, Master Sorrelin. I choose those best suited to the tasks at hand based upon their ability. You've been put into harm's way in my service, and might be again.
Yes, sir, Benedict said, as if the Spyrak had stated that water was wet.
Addison nodded and said,
We're about to have 40 new recruits this year, and as many returning veterans. I'll see you both at the palace at the end of the training cycle to take your vows and sign your contracts.
Of course, sire, Gwen said. Sire?
Miss Lancaster,
the Spyrak said reprovingly.
Addison, she said, and then added, Sir.
He smiled, mostly with his eyes.
Yes.
Had I known who you were earlier,
you would have been well within your right to react in precisely the same way, Miss Lancaster, he said firmly. Please excuse me for my rudeness. It's very seldom I get to be impolite for fun, and I'm afraid I have a rather depressingly low sense of humour. I trust you will forgive me.
She felt her cheeks heating up again.
Of course, sire.
There was a sudden, deep, hollow chime. Someone was ringing the bells at the centre of the Habbles Common area near the marketplace. Benedict tensed. Then he popped the second half of his second dumpling into his mouth in a single bite. Gwen pushed her dumpling toward him automatically, and he scooped it up in what was clearly an unthinking, instinctive reaction.
Ah, the Spyrak said, I believe I saw something in the notices about a duel to be fought today. I may have heard that the situation has the potential to be quite messy and ugly for those involved.
You wouldn't know anything about it, would you, Miss Lancaster?
His voice was calm, even whimsical, but there was something in his words that carried the hint of steel. I suspect you know very well that I do, sire.
His teeth showed briefly. Then I suspect that you plan to see it to the end.
We do, Benedict said in a quiet voice.
The Spyrak nodded.
A great many eyes are on what you do today, Miss Lancaster.
Among them, my own.
Gwen swallowed. The great chime tolled several more times, and then fell silent. The Spyrarch glanced toward the source of the sound and nodded in what was undeniably a dismissal.
The Targwyns are good people.
House Lancaster has always had my respect, miss. I expect today's events to vindicate that respect.
Gwen could recognize a command when she heard it, and her heart suddenly beat a little faster. This situation was no longer a simple mess caused by her lack of judgment. The attention of the Spyrarch meant that it had ramifications for her house as well.
"Yes, sire," she said, her throat dry. "They will."
Chapter 10. Spire Albion, Habble Morning. Bridget felt sure that she was going to be sick and throw up in front of half the Habble.
"Little mouse,"
Raoul said in a low, stern tone from her arms.
"Straighten your back. Lift your chin. Show no fear. Give your enemy nothing."
"That's very good advice, miss," said the Master of Arms in a similar tone, though speaking the human tongue. He was a tall, spare man, the threads of silver in his hair standing out sharply against his all-black outfit. They were waiting in the common area of the market of Habble Morning, near the dueling platform, and the grizzled, warrior-born man had just finished ringing the chimes.
"You speak cat, Mr.—"
Bridget flushed.
"I'm sorry. I don't know your name."
"Esterbrook, miss,"
he said with a slight polite bow. "I don't speak it well, but I understand enough.
All wise folk do." "I like him,"
Raoul said from Bridget's arms. She smiled faintly and tried to follow Raoul's advice.
"I apologize if I do something improperly, Mr. Esterbrook," she said, "but I'm afraid I have little experience in these matters."
"Wise folk don't," Esterbrook said calmly, giving her another smile. "It's simple enough, Miss Targwyn."
"I'm unclear as to what role a Master of Arms plays in a duel when it's being fought unarmed."
"Oh, my part doesn't change," Esterbrook said. "My office is filled by several of us old soldiers, with one of us covering each day of the week. My job is to do everything possible to make sure everyone lives. I seek to resolve the cause of the duel before any blood is shed, and then I ensure that the protocol of the duel is followed and that no one interferes in what happens."
She frowned. "Who would interfere?"
"His second, perhaps," Esterbrook said. He glanced at Raoul. "Or yours." Raoul gave a contemptuous flick of his ears and looked away.
"And if someone does not follow the rules?"
"I'll stop him," Esterbrook said. "It is within the rights of my office to take any steps necessary to do so, up to and including the taking of life."
Bridget blinked. "Goodness."
"Duels are serious business, miss," Esterbrook said quietly. "Though these arrogant sprats growing up these days don't seem to think so. They shouldn't be entered into lightly."
"They shouldn't exist at all," Bridget said.
Esterbrook seemed to think about that for a moment. Then he shook his head. "They serve a purpose, if they're kept within a strict structure, and if death doesn't result too often. There's something to be said for having the means to directly confront someone who has wronged you. For there to be a reason for these glib-tongued louts to show an ounce of courtesy and to guard their words."
"Ah,"
Bridget said, flushing slightly. As the glib-tongued lout in question, she was currently on the receiving end of this facet of the Habble's law.
"I'm not sure everyone would agree with you. We're a civilized society, are we not?"
Esterbrook blinked.
Since when, miss? We're a democracy.
Just what I mean. We have dispensed with violence as a means of governing ourselves, have we not?
The heart of democracy is violence, Miss Tarvin, Estabrook said. In order to decide what to do, we take account of everyone for and against it, and then do whatever the larger side wishes to do. We're having a symbolic battle. Its outcome decided by simple numbers. It saves us time and no end of trouble counting actual bodies, but don't mistake it for anything but ritualized violence. And every few years, if the person we elected doesn't do the job we wanted, we vote him out of office. We symbolically behead him and replace him with someone else. Again, without the actual pain and bloodshed, but acting out the ritual of violence nonetheless. It's actually a very practical way of getting things done.
Bridget blinked several times. I've never thought of it that way, she confessed.
It is one of the only things we respect about your people, Raoul put in. Though, of course, cats do it better.
Quite possibly, Estabrook agreed. Ah, here comes the physician, and your esteemed opponent, it would seem. Bridget looked around them. People were appearing from all over the market in response to the chimes, dozens of people, in fact. And only a moment later she was quite sure that dozens had become hundreds. She felt her throat turning very dry to go along with her fluttering stomach and her racing heart. Fear was really quite tedious. She wanted to be rid of it as soon as possible. A small man with silvery hair, carrying a physician's valise and wearing a very sensible, no-nonsense suit, approached Estabrook, and the two exchanged handshakes. Estabrook introduced the man to Bridget, though a few seconds later she had completely forgotten his name. The crowd continued to grow. At lunch, on a weekday, hadn't these people anything better to do with their time?
Bridget frowned at the crowd and restrained herself from rubbing Raoul's ears, which the cat would have found undignified in public. Reginald Astor appeared out of the throng, along with not only his second but half a dozen other men of the same general age and rank. He was dressed just as she was, in a plain grey training uniform. They approached as a group, Reggie swaggering in the lead. Beside her, Bridget felt Mr. Estabrook grow tight with coiled tension, something she sensed on a level below conscious thought. It was, she thought, almost the same sense she felt from a suddenly angered cat.
"Master of Arms," Reggie said, throwing the warrior-born man an exaggerated bow. "It's about time we did this, isn't it?"
Estabrook narrowed his feline eyes but inclined his head in respect.
"I am indeed the Master of Arms. My name is Elias Estabrook." "Details," Reggie said.
His eyes were focused intently on Bridget.
"There she is, the little trog with her little scavenger."
The idiot couldn't have known that it was a word the cats considered a deadly insult. Raoul catapulted up from his resting place in Bridget's arms toward Reggie, and it was all she could do to keep hold of the suddenly furious cat. Reggie reconfirmed his idiocy by bursting out in laughter, though at least his second had the wit to take an alarmed step back.
"Goodness," he said in a merry voice, "is the kitty upset with me? It's not as though I'm launching a suit to have the vicious little thing drowned."
"Raoul," Bridget hissed in cat, "settle down."
"I heard him,"
Raoul snarled.
"And he will be dealt with," Bridget said, "in the proper order of things. First, he is mine."
Raoul let out a spitting snarl of frustration and then settled down again, though his body remained quivering tight with tension.
"Mr. Estabrook," Bridget said, looking from Raoul to the man. "I am ready to begin, sir."
The warrior-born nodded. "In accordance with Spire law, I beseech you both to resolve your differences in some less dangerous and destructive manner."
No matter how well managed, loss of life and limb remains a possibility of any duel. I now ask you, Mr. Astor, if you will retract your grievance and avoid the dangers inherent in a confrontation.
She insulted the honor of my house, Reggie said loftily. She will apologize for it, or I will have satisfaction here and now.
Esterbrook turned to Bridget. Miss Targwin, will you offer such an apology?
Let me be clear that I never offered House Astor an insult to Mr. Esterbrook, Bridget said. Nor did I insult Reginald. I simply described him in accurate terms. If he finds himself insulted by the truth, it's hardly my concern.
A low, quiet round of chuckles went through the crowd.
But, in any case, Bridget said, I stand by what I said. Truth does not become untruth simply because its existence upsets the scion of a high house.
Esterbrook's eyes glinted, and he nodded once.
Let the record show that neither combatant finds a way to resolve their differences peaceably. We will therefore proceed to contest. Mr. Astor, is your second present?
Yes, here, of course,
Reggie said, beckoning his cousin Barnabas forward.
Miss Targwin, is your second present?
I am,
Ralph said, in cat. Esterbrook nodded seriously, and another murmur ran through the crowd, a mixed sound of amusement, disgust, confusion, excitement, and other things Bridget couldn't quite make out.
Point of order,
Reggie said, in a voice meant to carry to the entire crowd.
This is a violation of dual protocol. Miss Targwin has arrived without a second.
Esterbrook looked at Reggie with a blank expression.
Oh? The law states, Reggie continued, that a duelist's second must be a citizen of Ahabel in good standing with the law.
Reggie sneered at Raoul.
And as I see no such person here, I can only conclude that Miss Targwin did not bring a second.
I insist that she be prosecuted for acting in contempt of spire law, and her house fined appropriately.
Bridget's stomach plunged. It happened only on rare occasions, when someone felt the need to punish a house that had not left itself vulnerable in any other way. But when fines were levied for violations of spire law, they tended to be outrageous. Even the smallest of the fees that could be forced upon her father would quite literally beggar him.
Master Astor, Esterbrook said, and to Bridget's surprise, his own voice was pitched to carry as well. When it comes to supporting the letter and spirit of the law, your dedication and zeal are selectively remarkable.
He reached into his coat and produced a folded writing sheet. I have here in my possession an affidavit, reviewed and notarized by Judge Helena Solomon. It states that one Raoul, heir apparent of House Silent Paws, has, with the rest of his house, pledged his support to His Majesty, Addison Orson Magnus Jeremiah Albion, first citizen and spirearch of Albion. Further, the affidavit states that he resides within Habel Morning, and that no outstanding fines or warrants have been levied against him. As such, he is, in fact, a citizen of the Habel.
In good standing.
What?
Reggie said.
House what?
Esterbrook diffidently offered him the writing sheet. Reggie snatched it and stared, reading. His cheeks turned bright red, and the crowd began to murmur again. Bridget's gaze fell on a plain, rather dumpy man standing not too far away, in the first row of gawkers. Unlike the others, he was not speaking to anyone else. There was something familiar about him, something that reminded her of her primary schooling days, but she couldn't pin down the proper memory. His graying hair was shaggy, his suit years out of style, and if he hadn't been the only person in sight who appeared absolutely calm and undistracted by Esterbrook's pronouncement, she might never have taken notice of him. She felt his eyes meet hers. A glitter of mirth passed through them, and he gave her a wink. Bridget blinked. That was rather bold of him, whoever he was. Was he one of her father's business associates?
someone she'd met when she was much younger. She was sure she would have remembered. And why was she gawking at the man when she realized one of the most important legal precedents in the Spire's recent history had just been made? Cats had been declared citizens of the Habbel. Apparently with all the rights and, much more critically, the responsibilities that status implied.
Cats and humans had enjoyed a long-standing arrangement,
but one that was entirely unofficial, and which either side could violate without necessarily creating enormous repercussions. But Esterbrook and his proclamation had just changed that balance immensely, and perhaps not, Bridget realized with dismay, for the good of all involved.
"This is not..." Reggie sputtered. "Cats are not eligible to..."
"According to the law, sir," Esterbrook said calmly, "they are. Have you any other complaints to make before we proceed, sir? Or perhaps you have changed your mind and would be willing to simply abandon this fruitless course?" Reggie narrowed his eyes, his gaze locking onto Bridget and Raoul.
"You're making a mockery of a noble tradition, beast man."
Esterbrook's feline eyes narrowed to slits, and there was a hint of a growl deep in his chest when he spoke. "I simply execute the responsibilities of my office, Master Aster. If that displeases you in some fashion, it is not my concern." Reggie's friends took note of the growl and gathered in close around him. Just then there were footsteps behind Bridget, and Gwendolyn Lancaster and Benedict Sorrelin appeared from the crowd. They were both dressed in civilian clothing, Gwen in a pearl-gray dress, vest and jacket, and Benedict in a simple, rather dismal black suit. Both of them, Bridget noted, were wearing gauntlets, the thick copper wire of the weapons cages wrapping around their left forearms. "Are we too late?" Gwendolyn asked. Bridget had no notion whatsoever how the prim little noblewoman managed to load so much arrogance and confidence into her seemingly fatuous tone. "I do hope we haven't missed the display of courage and grace that this little event promises to be. Goodness, Reggie, here you are, with 6 friends." She gave Aster a blindingly white smile and counted them, moving her hand in a seemingly unconscious gesture. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Gwendolyn, Bridget noted, used her gauntlet-clad left hand to count. The copper cage glinted in the noonday light.
"I thought 2 were all that were needed for a duel," Benedict said, his tone weighted with exaggerated confusion.
"Indeed," Gwendolyn replied. "Reggie seems to have become befuddled."
"I can help," Benedict said. And then his manner changed, the false drama vanishing. He simply stared at them, no expression at all on his face. "Come, boys, let's the 5 of you and I leave Reggie and his second to this business. I'll buy you each a round, and you can decide which fight you want to watch."
"Which fight?" Gwen asked. "Whatever do you mean?"
"They have a choice," Benedict said. "Watch Reggie fighting Bridget, or me fighting them. One will take a great deal less time than the other."
"Sorrelin," Esterbrook growled, his tone full of gentle reproof. "I'll have no brawling here."
"Sir," Benedict said with a nod, "it won't be a brawl, sir."
Esterbrook seemed to consider that for a moment, and then nodded.
"Very well, then."
Bridget thought, with some satisfaction, that Reggie's crowd of hangers-on looked rather nervous. They were trying for arrogant, but the way they had all unconsciously moved a few inches back from Benedict was rather telling.
"You can't threaten me, Sorrelin," Reggie snarled.
Benedict blinked several times. "Reggie, my old friend, I wouldn't disturb your business today for the world. You know exactly where you reside within my personal regard. I would never harm a hair on your head."
"I might," Gwen put in cheerfully. "I've got this lovely new gauntlet, and I've never actually used it on anyone."
Esterbrook cleared his throat.
"Oh, piffle,"
I didn't use it on you, only near you, she said to him. But Reggie, let me be perfectly clear. You sought this duel, and you're going to have it. You and your second. And your friends can watch like everyone else. There will be no distractions, no moments of confusion, no mysterious objects flung from the crowd. Just you on the platform. She smiled.